I thought we would try to gather from you some of the situations that you would like to have discussed, where we will all contribute and be helpful about. Maybe I might share along the line some of the perspectives I have about being in the parsonage, and as I look back through the years and the varying situations. But mostly I would like it for this to be your session when you raise questions or make contributions that will be helpful each to the other. You know, the old crazy, what did they call it, sexual competition? What did Dad always used to call that, John? I can't remember.
The battle of the sexes?
Battle of the sexes. That's exactly what it was. And I used to just rise up to that. I hated to have my life characterized, you know, as being a battle between the one I love, even. There are a lot of funny little stories, but I think it's kind of cute, the one that's told about a husband who looked at his wife and he thought, well, you know, he hadn't said anything very nice to her for a long time, so he began telling her how much he thought of her and how accomplished he thought she was. And she patted his knee gently and said, "That's all right, dear, you deserve me." Well, this is sort of a kind of a little give and take. And maybe just to begin with, I will say this to you in the perspective of our own years, my years in the parsonage. Before the Lord tapped my husband on the shoulder, we've been married 45 years. Sort of kind of funny, I always used to remind him of I was 28 years old when I was married. I was a school teacher. In fact, I was planning to go to India as a missionary and corresponded with Dr. Mary Markley at that time. I'd been reading Tagore, you know, the beautiful poetry of that great mind of India and some of their other backgrounding, and thought it would be a fascinating place to be able to give my life. I'd heard missionary doctors at college, and so that was going to be it. And then we met at a Luther League conference at Lake Minnetonka. He was president of the Minnesota Luther League. And some of us decided we'd like to swim across the lake together. Well, in those days you had to have a boat if you were going to do that. I still think they ought to use a boat. Please, John, take notice about that. But they do use a boat when they go across our lake. The kids, you know, think the old fuddy-duddy is pretty strict about the water things, but I have seen too many people not use good judgment and then rude afterward. Anyhow, we had to wait for him because he was at a committee meeting, because he was swimming on one side of the boat and I was swimming on the other. And when we got to the other side, I thought it'd be fun to swim back. It was a 3-mile swim, but in those days I was pretty husky and didn't mean a thing. But he used all his energy to do it. He writes about how he pulled himself up in the dock and thought, wow, now I've done that. And when I said, "Come on, let's swim back," that just about blew up. But the little interesting touch in that regard is there was a rule in camp that boys and girls, young men and young women, should not be in a boat together in their swimming suits. Oh. And you should have seen the swimming suits, you know. Well, anyhow, we did. Maybe we compromised ourselves. We rode back in the boat together. Anyhow, that was a part of the beginning. And it's a fun story to think back to. And you each have your own stories. If my husband were here, he would draw out of each one of you how you met. You know, he loved romance. And get those details and would think back to that sort of a thing. The thing I wanted to really say about that was that I was married to a man who I think loved his work more than anything else anybody could ever do. He felt so privileged to be an ambassador of Jesus Christ as a pastor, that was the tone of his ministry all the way through the tough times and the good ones. And I would have been remiss had I not caught that wonderful spirit of, this is a beautiful opportunity that we have to be the channels of God's love in this particular way. And when we could be together in that unity, the other differences had a way of, after a while, melting. I would be a liar if I didn't say there were differences. In fact, I think I should confess to you at this point that there were times, had we not been Christian, I think either one of us might have left the other. Who was it? The man, I can't remember the name of the pastor in Minneapolis, and his wife, who've written a book on marriage, and they tell in there, and it's a story, John, I've heard you kind of use too, about the couple who'd been married 50 years, and they asked him, well, did you ever think of leaving your wife? No, he said he never really thought of leaving her, but he did have murder in mind a couple of times. and I guess something of that kind of a tie underneath all the differences is a wonderful thing to keep in mind. And then I will just say this one other thing, and then I'd like to have you think about questions that you'd like to have us discuss so that we can get into the areas that mean the most to you. I forgot what I was going to say right then. Do you ever have that happen? Oh, I know. It came. As the years grew, as we grew older together, as we had experienced more and more of life together, do you know what? It became more beautiful all the time. And I sometimes think our last years, there was such a joy in fellowship together. Just the two of us, we loved other people too, but we could just have such a good time together that it was really a foretaste, I'm sure, of what's to come. And maybe it was just too much, you know, you'd be so happy to live on and on and on that way, and to keep that home longing in one's heart. This life, I don't suppose ever ought to really be that good. But I give you this prospect of when you two, in a single purpose of living, challenge for what you want to do with your life. And that doesn't mean you're going to agree on everything by any manner or means. But it means that one basic priority and purpose, and that you are one, then life grows increasingly more beautiful, even as your body gets more frail, and that may be the joys, the physical joys of outdoor exercise, and that thing have to become less and less. But it's a beautiful thing to grow old together in the Lord. And I say that to you with all the honesty that I have within me. The hard thing is then the loneliness afterward. And that's something that we need maybe to talk about too. Now, what are some of the things you'd like to discuss about being in the parsonage?
When you were active in your thing, he was active in his thing, and you were, I assume you were as active as you are now or more, and time was sometimes hard to grasp at, and you came to those moments of real burnout. How did you handle it? How do you?
I'm trying to think specifically, trying to remember back to the kind of thing you're talking about. I think I maybe mentioned earlier, each of us had a different way of responding. I wanted to talk it out. And perhaps his way was better. He sealed up like a clam. It was just about doing me bad. But then the cooling, then there had to be a withdrawal, a cooling off period, and getting a perspective. And I can't remember that we ever went to sleep at night without having come to some agreement, which is a wonderful thing. It's to get away and get a perspective. I could get out in the kitchen and get busy perhaps with things I needed to do, and then I'd kind of look at the thing and think, well, how silly, you know. Who makes the first move toward the other thing? I think in Dad's book, he mentions that, you know, I think very often the woman does. She comes and says, I'm sorry. We have a funny little story that he used to share, too, about when we lived in Chicago, I had to make it to the airport. He was wonderful about cooperating with me. And I say this to you, husbands, it's a beautiful thing to for a wife to know that her mate will help in every way he can, for her to express herself too. So there, as far as I was aware of, there was never any jealousy or any sense of competition. In fact, he constantly encouraged me when I would like to have withdrawn sometimes. So there was There was that. Now, I'm just laying my soul open to you. But if we were traveling down the Kennedy Parkway in Chicago, we were about 35 miles from O'Hare. I was to be at a retreat in Rocky Mountain District. And time was of the essence. And, you know, if you know Chicago, 4 or 5 lanes, trucks zooming along and all. And I was worried, and I'd say, turn right, you know. And sitting in the front seat. Now, ordinarily, Dad was just wonderful. He said, 2 pairs of eyes are better than 1. And he wanted my help when I'd see. But this got a little much. And he perhaps was nervous, too. So he turned to me and he said, I'll drive this car. Well, you know, good little me trying to be helpful. And then have that kind of response. I knew we were going to be parted for some days. And I thought, oh, man. And I sat looking out at those trucks passing by. Holy Spirit had to do an awful lot of working on me at that point. But finally I did turn to him and I said, I'm sorry. That must have been awfully tough for you, you know, and I realized it could make you nervous, and I'm sorry. And he kind of cleared his throat and he said, I accept your apology. Wow, I had to begin all over. Aren't we funny creatures, though, when it comes right down to it? And so I would simply say that it's to withdraw, and now this may seem simple to you, but it's the honest workings of my faith to withdraw and pray about it quietly, and then see what the Lord does for you. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, I know you can trust him if you're open to it at all. So what if you ask for forgiveness? Of course, it's rough to ask for it when you think you're kind of right inside. but you've had something to do with the situation. And we talked about communication, and I can't tell you how I feel, how basic this is, you know, to be really able to be open with one another. If we could say, now come on, let's sit down and talk about this, you know, calmly. And you can after a while. And I heartily commend to each of you to use it. This is also true in relationships to your children. Oh, I regret how much, how many times I've been not sensitive enough to be able to be aware of their needs as they came in. And we do need to be able to communicate. We were talking about the communication and how you can get words mixed up. I guess, you know, there are many funny things. The little boy that went to school, mother was so eager for him to really like it. And when he came home, she said, well, how was it, John? He said, ah, it was no good. She said, how can you say that? He said, the teacher told a lie. She said, well, John, you know the teacher didn't tell a lie. What makes you say that? Well, he said, when I came in there, I went up to her desk and I said, where shall I sit? She said, well, you can sit over here for the present. And he said, I sat all morning and I never got any presents. Well, it doesn't take much to, you know, throw you off. I have to tell you one other story this time. This actually happened. Ernie Johnson's were moving from Washington to Springfield, Ohio, and he'd gone ahead to make arrangements for some housing situation. And then Olga was going to come later on the train. And a very, you know, nice-looking young woman was the real estate agent. And so when he went to the train to meet her, she was along because they were going to show her the house that they were looking at. And she was coming onto the station platform, but her bag was, you know, out in front there. And she heard him say to this lovely young lady, oh, there's the old bag. Wow! You know what she thought? That he was talking about her instead of the bag. And so, you know, a lot of situations can arise that we're really not responsible for. Did that answer it a little bit? And then not to be afraid to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry is a wonderful word, if you really mean it. But John's little boy, Joshua, Junie tells a story about how he was naughty in church one Sunday. And when they came home, she said to him, Joshua, I got to punish you. You were a naughty boy. Well, he says, I'm sorry. No, yeah, he said, I'm sorry. And she said, well, it isn't enough to be sorry. You've got to really be different. Oh, he says, I'm different. He was ready to concede, you know, whatever. Anybody else? What would you like to have a share? Well, let's discuss the matter of career and being in the parsonage. Would you be interested in talking about that, having work outside of the home. They teased me because they said I hadn't worked for 45 years of married life, and I started, you know, last year. And I, again, I think of when Dave came home with a sheet of questions that he had to fill out for school, and it said, does your mother work? And he put, yes. And I said, why, Dave? Well, Mom, you do too work, he said. You work hard. I thought that was awfully nice. I just feel so often we try to set up patterns for everybody. And I think that's for the birds. I don't think any one of us can say to the other what the pattern ought to be. I think you each must decide on the basis of your gifts that God has given, of your training that you have, of the particular situation that is yours. For some women, it's wonderful, you know, for them to make home their career. And that's a beautiful career. And there's so many things that can be said about it, of joy. The little extra touches and the fun of laughter in it, and having open hospitality and not being so tired that you have to forego a lot of those things. I treasure the joy of homemaking in a great, great way. But for someone, they'd be worse making home, you know, that way when they have these other gifts than they would be if they'd go out and come back to it. And I think that we cannot set a pattern for everybody. I think some women can beautifully handle that kind of a situation. The question I think I would ask is, why are you having this other job? Yes.
What I see in this, and the discontent of some of these women, and I try and say, none of these are static situations. Possibly you need to be in the home for a few years now, but there are so many years to do other things that they often look at it as if, well, I am going to be in the home and be a mother and a housekeeper and a drudge forever.
Right.
And it's not that way.
No. And I think you've pointed out one little generalization that I would be willing to adhere to, and that is that if you can be there when the children are small, I think it's very wonderful. I can remember the joy of coming in the door, Mom, and all you needed to do was to answer, then they'd maybe be out somewhere else, but you know, the fact that that you were there was something. On the other hand, I think of the beautiful little children that a black friend of mine has. She's been just entered into the medical school of the University of Minnesota, and she comes through it the hard way. She has two children alone. The man that fathered the children out east is in a mental institution. She finished high school with those two children, and now she has them with her there. And she's had to set this kind of a pattern for her life. She takes them to school in the morning at 5 and 7, and fortunately this school has, what is it, a key
latchkey
program, so the children can stay afterward until 5 when she's through at the university and can pick them up. And I said to her, well Lynn, when do you study? She said, well, then, you know, we're all kind of hungry right then, so I fix dinner and we have dinner with leisure, and then we have a little time together, and then it's time for our baths and the children to go to bed. Then she said, I go to bed too. And I get up at 1:32 and 2 o'clock and do my study. And that's the way she's going to be able to put herself through medical school. And she'll do it, because she's seen herself through college. Now that really requires a lot of discipline. The beautiful part of it is, she's wanting to do this to become a doctor and to go back into the ghetto in Chicago and serve her people in that way. But she also, you see, is a committed Christian. And that's a part of the pattern. Now, for Lynn, that's got to be the way. For others, that would be impossible, you know. So we each have to sort of set our own pattern. What are some of the things we can do to make homemaking not a drudgery, would you say?
Well, I think with all of our modern things that we have now, you get done what you have to get done first. You get it out of the way so you get time to do what you want.
All right, what can we do to bring into the home another element than just the physical, you know, well-being? Because as you say, we have all the equipment that helps us get that put out of the way. What are some of the touches that we could add to making family life more rich? Yes.
possibly writing words to a song that you could sing in the evening time.
Yes, and you call forth another possibility, having the family look at the song at the table together. What are some of the, now in the parsonage, the problem that so often couples speak to me about isn't so true, because you really can arrange your working schedule for the most part so that you can have a couple of meals together, can't you? Certainly, you know, most days. There are some days when that isn't true. Some parents have a very difficult time about that because of the staggered work schedule, to be able to have a time together around the table. But as a mother, I would say those were our most precious hours in the home, the dinner hour together, when the boys would come from their paper routes, and when Dad would come, and maybe he'd have to go out calling in an hour and a half. Even in Duluth, I can remember, and this is where a homemaker, I think, can be helpful. For you to put yourself out to plan ahead or be flexible enough to plan into the time. When there would be a beautiful day in the matter of weather, and Dad would come home maybe at 5 o'clock, and I'd say, look, it's such a beautiful day. I've got lunch back. We're going out to the cove and have a picnic tonight before you have your meeting at church. That's the way we had to pick up time. But now the family, kind of like a shrine, goes to that cove every summer. We have a picnic out there because it was a time of family together and a happy time of family together, you see. And to bring some imagination into it, little surprises around the table. And then to make the even the setting something that's pleasant. You know, you can use the simplest thing. You don't have to have rich things. You don't have to have a lot of money. But little touches can add that extra glow. And then I think of participation in the conversation. What do we do very often as older people when children are around? Forget they're there. Now, I think that's a very real mistake. I think when the children are with you, they should be included, rather than you're talking over their heads or utterly ignoring them. And that can be a wonderful give and take. And a sharing again. And there are these many things. There's another thing that I wish we, I know it's nostalgic, and I didn't do nearly enough of it. Did in the earlier years, much, much more so than in the later ones. But you know, to read to them, to read together things as a family, to enlarge the wonderful background of the wonder of books, and to whet appetites for those. That's a fun thing. I don't know if the children would even remember it. We also tried to vary our family devotional pattern as much as we could, because that can get into a rut. And one fun time when we were in Duluth that we had was, for a week, we'd go to a different country that we knew about each night, you know, like the missionaries and all, even tried to have the food maybe relate to it a little bit. I can remember the story that I think it was Margaret Freeberg told them about the four little boys in China. And it's to make come alive the world picture and people around the world about these little boys who were street boys. And the missionary came to them and said, where do you live? And they said, we can't tell you, because if we tell you, you'll tell the police. And she finally persuaded them. They said, we got four little stoves, and the police will take the stoves away from us. Finally, she persuaded them that she wouldn't tell the police and the stoves wouldn't be taken away, but she'd like to see. She wondered what their stoves were. And they took her to a corner of the Chinese wall where their home was, four bundles of straw. And you know what their stoves were? They each had a little puppy to snuggle. Aww. And that's what they were afraid. Now, the kids loved that story. I remember telling it when we were doing tricks and treats, only we didn't do that. We called in Washington in the very early days before the United Children's Fund took over for folks to let the children go out and gather feathers. We did it for China this one year. And when I told that story, when I went around to the schools and would tell that story, you'd just be amazed at the way they went around and got rice and powdered milk. And the State Department saw too that it was sent over, you know, in that respect. And they responded to that. Children respond to people's needs in a wonderful way. Oh, I would say have a project for others, you know, too. There's so many opportunities where you can be adopting a child through the Children's Fund or something like that, but to have come alive your spiritual life and the way you express it in thinking about others is a wonderful way. I remember, John, it'd be better if you weren't here, because
keeping her honest.
All right. You see, we don't always remember the same thing. I want to be absolutely sure. But I remember when we had Dr. Mary Moses in our home. She was a national missionary in India. She was one of the first women. You remember Dr. Mary Moses. She was in Bhimavaram. Just think, my husband and I were privileged to visit her in Bhimavaram. She'd been our guest in the home. And this one night, we were talking about India. And in my prayer, said, please God bless Dr. Mary Moses in India. He came to me afterward and he said, Mom, do you think you have to tell God where Mary Moses is? And then he was going to be so worldwide in his expression. That time we were doing the world, and we talked about these Chinese children. So he prayed, please bless all the little lonely children in China, and bless all the folks that speak Swedish. Yes?
One of the creative things we loved about your family was your inviting people. Your table was always larger than your own four children, and you and your husband, and so many of us were recipients of being at the table and the board with you, and I would think that would have been an enriching thing for your own family as you had so many different people.
Dick, I feel we were blessed more than anything that we ever did. We were so blessed by the enrichment. In Washington, D.C., of course, we had the international opportunity so tremendously. But even in Duluth, remember the Magleys from British Guiana that came, and how enthralled the boys were about learning how they fished. And, you know, these are the things you lose if you aren't open to hospitality and catch up. And it was never fussy, you know. It was just to share what you had. But we always did, too, share the other bread that we grow. I'll just quickly tell you later about these four men in India. But when the Magleys came, and the boys, they kept asking them about, you know, things in British Guiana. They were from India, but were Lutherans. He was a Lutheran pastor in British Guiana. And then he told about how they went fishing there, of how that there was a little ball that was made out of certain herbs. Now, the family that knew this wouldn't give you the secret, but they give you balls to fish with. But that secret was handed down from generation to generation. And you'd throw the ball in the river, and the fish would nibble at it, and he'd become drunk, and he'd jump up, and then you'd net your fish. Well, that was kind of a different way of fishing. That was kind of fun to hear about. And then I remember Dr. Tildequist in Duluth being so interested, and when they told about how they went hunting quite a distance away, and it's very hot, and for instance, a deer would, you know, become bad by the time they could get it from the pace they'd killed it. And so they had a certain something they put at the tips of the arrows. And when that hit the animal, it anesthetized it, you know, so that it was preserved and they got it home in good shape. And you know that from that thing, the doctors began investigating in New York and found something that they used for operations. In the matter of freezing and all. You see, the implications of how that goes out. But all that comes from that, from just having folks in there. We had four men from India one night in Washington. We were listed there in the international hospitality. They were Hindu. And I knew that there were certain food prohibitions. And you try then to be aware of those, as when I remember that Muslim from Pakistan ate with us. We had leg of lamb. That was in the day when, you know, you didn't have to be a millionaire to have a leg of lamb. But I thought he was going to eat the whole leg. Lamb was one thing he could eat, you know, and he hadn't had any for a long time in America. But my, the appreciation. Well, anyhow, the children were very fine about relating to these men, asking them about their children and what their homes were like and all. So then when it came time for us to have our devotions, Dad read the 13th chapter of Corinthians, the love chapter, and he read it from Phillips. So the English, you know, was quite simple. And these men were so taken. You know what they did when he finished reading? They applauded. That was kind of an interesting reaction. But from that, and then we had our prayer circle, and some of the children remembered their families and their children, you know. And apparently this deeply moved these men, and I remember sitting for 2-3 hours in the living room that Saturday night. And they kept asking questions. And the last question was, could we come to your church tomorrow morning? Now, I don't know anything. We picked them up, and they were in church. But, I mean, it was novelly interesting finding a common ground just by being interested in them as people. I would heartily commend. Thank you for reminding me, Dick, of the joys that can come if you open your home to others that maybe aren't just like you, too, of all kinds. And that's a beautiful blessing that I can't be grateful for enough. Well, what else? What are some of the problems in the parsonage today? Aren't there any? It's, was it Dr. Barclay, one of the theologians, that said, blessed is the man who has a wife, someone that he can come home to when he's desperately in need of someone to listen to him. Yes.
Yeah, I had a doctor tell me once that when women or pastors' wives think they have to do so much in the church, he said if they would realize that their first calling is really to their husband, they wouldn't have to be involved at all in the program, but their real service to the church is just to be alive.
Now you brought up a very interesting point, and I'm glad because it's one of the things I had thought about. What do you do in the parsonage that you wouldn't do if you were a lay Christian? I mean, lay, we all are lay, but if you weren't in the parsonage. And I would say to anyone, what I did in the parsonage, I did because I was a Christian. I would have done it no matter whose wife I had been. And I think that should be the criterion, not that you're the minister's wife. So that what you're moved to do is the judgment God gives you by, you know, your particular stewardship of your gifts. That makes a difference. And each, I wanted to say this, you're each different. It would be awful if people patterned themselves after Ruth Nelson. What a sicky world. Really, God's beautiful variety of people means that there's a variety of witnesses, there's a variety of expressions, there's a variety of gifts. And that's why I say I hate to be boxed in and say, well, you know, I'll be with you. I was with Marge Wool this week before last at a pastor's wives retreat in Green Lake. And she told me something that just made me want to almost vomit about myself. She told me when she was a young bride down in Texas, a couple had come down from Minnesota. And this woman had kept saying to her, this young woman, oh, you ought to be like Ruth Nelson. So she just hated me, you know. Can't you imagine that? Ick. That's awful. For anyone to pattern themselves, you know. God is, you're unique. Celebrate your uniqueness. But do it as unto him. And when he is the one that guides you, you will give back in your way the way you should. And you steward your capabilities in all the way you ought to. And I would just emphasize that. Don't try to pattern yourself. There was an old verse that's very poor grammar, but illustrates, if I can remember it now, it went, the sunflower ain't a daisy, and the melon ain't a rose. Why is they all so crazy to be something else that grows? Just stick to the place you're planted and do the best you know. Be the sunflower or the daisy, the melon or the rose. If you ain't what you, if you am not what you are, then you is not what you ain't. If you're a little tadpole, don't you try to wag, no. If you're the tail, don't try to wag the dog, you know. But just be what you are is the idea. I'm not getting it out of it. Haven't done it for a long time and I forgot. But that matter of remembering that you are unique to the Lord. When I was a little girl in Augustana Church, I'm back in the church in which I was baptized. On the Swedish, on this baptismal fountain, is carved, let the little children come to me. And that's where my father and mother stood and brought me to the Lord in baptism. It's a precious thing for me. Micah was baptized in that church. And my husband had just come from the hospital. He was pretty weak. And I can see little Micah, that's John's little handicapped boy from Korea, putting his elbows on the bed. He put his crutches down and his elbows on the baptismal font looking up at Grandpa there. And now when he goes past, that's my church, he says. He always wants to see his church in Minneapolis where he was baptized. But when I was a little girl, about 3-4 years old, my mother had taught me that simple little hymn, I am Jesus' little lamb, therefore glad at heart I am, Jesus loves me, Jesus knows me. All that's good and fair he shows me. Tends me every day the same, even calls me by my name. And do you know that last little line has been such a joy to me all my life. I remember on 11th Avenue there, the house is still standing right next to the Augustana Apartments, the red brick house that my father built. It was a long hallway upstairs. And I'd walk that hallway saying, Ruth, Ruth, you know, as if the Lord were talking to me. And to remember that he even knows me by my name, that unique individuality that you are. And the Lord, you know, it's the miracle of God, how he can know us each, I don't know. But I know he does. And that's a beautiful thing for you to be able to share with your children and to realize about yourself that you have gifts, and to compare them with other people is not the thing. I think the evenings when I needed to be the listening wife, maybe more than any other time, was when he came home after board meetings. And I sometimes had to be like Katie Luther. I should have dressed in black and say, you know, said, do you think God's dead? Or, you know, because that would be it. Now you men can shut your ears for a moment. To have the delicate sensitivity as to when to listen sympathetically, not ooze with, you know, poor you. And when to challenge, you know. And that's not only for the wife to know, but it was, oh, how many times my husband played that role for me. It stood me up as to the challenge there was, rather than, you know, sympathize with me at the, maybe a task that I thought was very hard. Oftentimes when I was going to speak, and I'd moan and groan about, oh, you know, how concerned I'd be about it, he would be the one that would say, look, you know that God will help you through, you know, and really put a little starch into me. That's what we need. That's why we need to be doing for each other. I think it's so silly to talk about competing when we ought to be each complimenting, you know, sharing each with our particular gifts in the way that we have them. And that then it becomes a good relationship. Anybody else? I'll bet there are things I haven't touched on. Why do they break up? Why are so many parsonage families breaking up? What do you think? Oh, I hear about a new one almost every day, it seems to me. Yes.
Some of us were talking today about divorces in parsonages, and a number of cases have been because the wife has taken a career and somehow they have not been able to work this out together. And some of us were mentioning if this were done on the basis of a whole family, the children, the husband, the wife, each working together. We were talking to someone, and Mrs. Douglas, at the time that we were having an all-Lutheran women's conference, and she was going to be speaking on this. She had done a survey in the college where she was teaching of women who have gone back to school after the age of 35. And they found that 85% of the women who went back to school in 2 years' time had a divorce.
Now, but isn't was, that often why they went back to
well,
school?
Well, this is what I was going to say. Okay, that there, this could not in any way really say too much for a trend, because they had no statistics on how many of them were in trouble before
right.
they ever went to school.
And needed an outlet or something. Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. And so that wasn't it. But this had changed her whole way of thinking, because she said the important thing for the wife and the husband is that they talk over any changes that they have in their family life, and that the children are brought into this. And so if mother goes to work, great. But the children have their part in it, and husband knows he has to change his way of life a little bit. And they work the thing out together rather than one or the other just going off.
That's the key again, that communication, that openness of exchange. We used to talk about having a family council. I can't remember, John, how many times we had one. But I remember my nephew said, yeah, they have a family council, and Aunt Ruth is a majority. Now that was his conclusion. Yes.
But isn't part of this also that we have the feeling that we fall in love and we fall out of love, when in reality it's a decision we make if we love somebody and we aren't aware of it? Or a lot of people aren't aware of it. So if we decide not, if something happens, it's that we've decided that we don't love that person anymore. maybe it's been a process, but if we do something to strengthen people, to see what kind of decisions they're making, and when something starts to happen, it maybe wouldn't have to happen.
That's certainly worth thinking about. Falling in and out of love, that's, well, what's love? I guess we ought to be talking. Well, there's the physical attraction, surely. That's perhaps the first thing that's available. What other dimensions does love have? Yes, anybody, were you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's so many divorces because divorces become acceptable. And I think parsonages probably aren't unusual with other professions that are very demanding of the husband. Often they've given so much to so many that by the time they get home, they don't have much left to give. And because divorce has become acceptable, that gets chosen. Whereas a generation ago, it wasn't fair. It wasn't a choice. It wasn't viable.
Do good marriages just happen? No. You got to work at them. And lots of times they are not willing to, yes.
They're willing to work for everything else, and yet we think good marriages are just going to happen. That's been the gobbledygook we were fed right from the little fairy tales, you know, and they lived happily ever after. Like, it just, there it was. But people work for houses and boats and all kinds of other things, but they aren't willing to work in a marriage.
I mentioned this morning this one that I just heard about in Washington, and the reason the mother of the lady gave me was that the fellow was so absorbed in his work that he just didn't pay any attention to the children and all, and of course that can happen in the parsonage easily too. I mean, that where you get so absorbed in even doing for other people that sometimes you forget the needs of those close at hand too. I think that's something that God needs to true us up to. I can remember my husband saying nostalgically that if he had his life to live over again, one thing he would do would be to take more time to, you know, listen to the children and to be with them. We did have our summers together, but otherwise it was to catch as catch can. But I also felt that there was a place where, that I could play. Like when we came to Washington, I insisted that every Saturday, at least afternoon, because the Sundays were so full, we were going to go on some kind of a jaunt, you know, to kind of sightsee. While we saw the city. The big treat, by the way, was a custard cone. You know, you got them for what, 10 cents? You know, at that time. But it was fun. And I do think if we can work cooperatively like that, you see, it won't just happen. You've got to plan, and you've got to put yourself into it. And I think very often, in your story of those statistics, they're frightening, aren't they? That, you know, that should have happened. But are you willing to work at a thing when you begin to see it slip? And do you want to save it? Would be the thing, wouldn't it? Who are the ones that suffer? It's so obvious it's the children, isn't it, that pay the price, get torn between these many situations. Yes?
In a relationship to that is the idea that the man, or, one moment, let me back up. The old idea from society putting upon the pastor the guilt feeling of taking time for himself.
I know it.
I know in our own relationship, there's been times when I've said, you haven't taken your day off for 2 weeks. Can we now have some time together? And, oh no, I've got some Sunday school meeting or something on Saturday. And that, I think there's some guilt feeling there too that maybe...
I'm sure that's very right. Certainly in the tradition in which I was brought up, there's a workaholic, you know, almost kind of a feeling. And as you say, a guilt situation. A young pastor not long ago was telling about a reviewing committee coming to him in the prospect of a call. And one of the questions they asked was, what hours do you keep? Because apparently the previous pastor kept very strict hours. And sometimes that wasn't, you know, you can go to that extreme too, but I wasn't sure about the response that, although in the spirit he made it was beautiful, he said 24 hours was the response. Yeah. He wanted the call, of course. But I think you pointed out a very real thing that this matter of guilt, about I ought to be doing this and that and the other thing. Yes.
I'm just going to say we have tickets to the Seattle Symphony, and that's what it is. It's on Monday night, every other, whatever it is. We have that night set, and very rarely, it has to be something really important before Norm misses that Seattle Symphony.
That's
and
good.
Then I take one of the children, and they gotta enjoy that.
Yeah.
But we've had to make
right.
dates or way in advance with all our calendars, and you know, if we want to get together with friends that are not, you know, around, then you have to plan. And I don't care if it's 2-3 months, I call them up, and,
good.
And we clear all the calendars. And he says, "Oh, I've got a, oh, somebody called about a wedding." I said, "Are they in the church?"
Yeah.
I said, "We've had this on for 2 months."
Yeah.
And,
well, this, I think this is.
And reminding him, though.
This is the thing that has got to be planned, and you've got to make it important. We had tickets for the symphony, both in Duluth and in Washington, and often we didn't get to go. We had to give them away. And sometimes when we went, we were so tired, we went to sleep. Honestly, it's terrible, you know, just so utterly weary that that lovely music just put us to sleep. Yes.
On this feeling of guilt, one thing that I think helped both Ken and I understand that better is when we both came to the realization that our marriage vow was every bit as sacred as this ordination vow.
Good. And so that there's a commitment there that God wants you to keep. I think that's good. Yes?
Something that I think is not just my husband and I that we don't have this problem. I think a lot of people do, and that's having making time. I mean, making time. Forget what everybody else says in the church, but make time, because he keeps, everybody comes to drain from him, and he doesn't get to be filled, and he needs that. Maybe, I can't say more, we all need it, but maybe more in some ways
right.
than other people. And
right.
Gordy, sometimes I just have to say, well, this is 3 days and we haven't done our family devotion.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because we never can find time. We try it at breakfast, and then, well, let's try it at lunch, well, let's try it at dinner. None of them work. You just got to make time.
That's it's got to be discipline. That's very, very right in this planning and giving yourself to. Yes.
One of the things we started a few years ago was take the phone off the hook for about 15, 20 minutes at dinner time.
That
invariably it was interrupted.
Because, then you always think, well, maybe there's an emergency.
No, because they'll get a busy signal. If
sure.
it's really an emergency, they can buzz.
Well, I agree with you. I think you just sometimes have to resort to situations.
Unplug the TV, too.
Oh, yeah, we don't go in that room.
Yeah. John, would you be willing to share a little bit of the way you have devotions with the children, drawing them out? I've enjoyed so much being...
Well, I was going to relate a story about the telephone, though. I remember one time we were just to have the grace before meal, and somebody picked up the phone and said, "Come, Lord Jesus." Well, we all used to laugh about how you'd be having a family fight over the table, and then somebody would call from the church and the sweetness on it. Hello.
But some of the other little things, little ways you drive.
Oh, I really, I think the suggestion of trying to get in the kids' wavelength and pulling them out on different questions, and also fixing memories together. I think to recall events and let each one reflect on that event themselves is to help build a family history. I think those family histories, one of the things that my dad did was great for us was write a book of his own story and the grandparents, and it's a private family book. It's not to be published, but to have those stories that we can share in common and rehearse as a family again gives our family a history, and kids can buy into that. So that's like when an event is done as part of the evening meal and the devotional time, is to reflect on it. What was good? What were you afraid about? What did you learn? The summer we went to Chicago and reflecting on their experience in the ghetto was terrific reflection of how the kids each perceived that social condition and some of the
some of the images that come out of that.
It's their participation that becomes, you know, they each, and I've always been so interested how eager they are, each one, you know, to be sharing their reaction to the question that will be asked. I remember your older boy David mentioning, well, one thing he found out that was he could walk pretty much anywhere in Seattle and feel free, but in Chicago, one block he was accosted, I guess, a couple of times. It was quite a, in the ghetto there, quite a revelation. And then they're counting the rats in the alleyway there. That was another thing that they weren't accustomed to. But to reflect on the day or the past experiences, out of them draw the things to be thankful for, or things that, you know, stood out in their minds. I think the participation of everybody in this matter of family devotions is very, very important. I remember the time when different translations were coming out and the children had learned to read. We tried to have a variety of translations as we were considering a passage. And then Dad would have a set of questions and you'd better have been listening, or you'd be, you know, especially Mother, you know, Mother, what do you think about this? And wow, you know, your mind might have been off. It's a, this matter of participation, and that follows through what you said, Cecilia, that, you know, talking the thing over together and being a part of the planning, that's what's so terribly important, I think.
One thing that's helped that for us, the supper table, was from the advent of the microwave. If you get into something, you don't have to worry about the food getting cold. You just do it, and then an hour later, you warm it up.
Are they paying you for an advertisement?
No, really.
Well, that's good.
To be able to follow something
through
at the moment is a thrilling thing. Yeah. That I was always too confined, you know, eat.
Yeah. Well, it's hot. Yeah.
Well, you know.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Well, I was just thinking, when you were talking about family devotions, I liked what you emphasized this morning about memorization, because I think it's so important, the things that we have in our minds, we never lose. In our family, we always, in our family devotions, we took time to learn psalms, we talked about them, and then we learned the psalms, and as the children went to confirmation, it was the catechism, mm-hmm. we learned all these parts. And when the children come home now, and we have our devotions, we can go over psalm after psalm, mm-hmm. and they can still remember all these words, and I think that's important.
I just wish we could, you know, really let you know, those of you who are younger, and with the school system has kind of thrown that out so much too, but it's coming back again. Surely you should understand what you're learning, I mean, for as much as we can, but the discipline of memory is beautiful. The singing too, songs. That was the whole purpose when I wrote God's Song in My Heart, because I felt if you sang that song once every day, you know, through the week, at the end of the week you would have learned it without trying. And oh, it's fun when you can sing. That's another thing that our families just love to do, is sing together in one way. Yes. Oh, excuse me. You were sewing, I guess.
No, I was in church.
Anybody else? I don't think you want to be kept unduly. And unless there's some question that you'd like to have raised, I think maybe we should conclude, because you've had a long day. Speaking of singing, let's pick up a song or two, shall we? The early church did that all the time when they got together, and you know, no matter what. And it's so easy for us to get out of it. We've had beautiful singing here. But
our 4-year-old's favorite that comes every night is Kumbaya.
Yeah, that's a good one. Do you know the story connected with that? When we've taught it to children, we've loved to just tell them supposedly the story of how it came to be is that there was in one of the countries of Africa this very sick little baby, and the parents had tried, the witch doctor had done everything he could to help the little child who was burning up with a fever, and nothing was helping. And then somebody came and said, well, there is a doctor, there's a mission doctor quite a ways away, and he does wonderful things. And so these runners went with come by here, you know, and one runner took it to one runner, and the story goes that the missionary doctor came and he was able to give antibiotics and left the little one resting in its mother's arms, you know, and that's supposedly the story of the writing of that song. Kumbaya,
kumbaya, kumbaya, kumbaya, kumbaya, kumbaya. Someone's crying, Lord, kumbaya. Oh, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's praying, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's praying, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's praying, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's singing, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's singing, Lord, kumbaya. Someone's singing, Lord, kumbaya. Oh, Lord, kumbaya.
Just one little postscript that came to me. You know, when I was young, we were singing... I think the songs tell so much about what's happening in a generation, the songs that come out. We were singing at college such songs as, I want a little bungalow where the red, red roses grow. We will live on love and kisses. Cupid, he will wash the dishes. Boys, a hamburger. In our house, in that bungalow where the red, red roses grow. That was typical of our age. When I talk to young people, I like to share this because I want to confess that that was a kind of gobbledygook, you know, we were singing. And that nostalgic harmonic one with someone like you, a pal so good and true, now that's beautiful. And boys, I had a wonderful pal. But you know what the last line of that one was? Let the rest of the world go by. And that was my generation, and that's why we're in a lot of the pickle we are today, because we didn't realize that we had no right to let the rest of the world go by. And I love some of the contemporary things that the young people have come to light with, you know, No Man Is an Island, some of the titles escaping now, but they are so pertinent to what we need to be doing today in the matter of the larger world. And so I would just pray that your homes may be places where the Lord is, through the thick and the thin, and you may know the joy and the beauty of growing old together with Him, and knowing that you can commit your children, your grandchildren, and the world to Him as you become also then a part of the answer as He gives you grace to do that. Shall we pray together the benediction? The Lord bless us and keep us.
The Lord make His face shine upon us and be gracious unto us. The Lord lift up His countenance upon us and give us peace. In the name of the Father, and